I love what I do. I still have a lot to learn, obviously, but I love the industry. I love the people. And it's a business that I don't think you ever retire from. You always will be doing something in this field. It's not something that you can just shut off.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Nailed It, a podcast powered by Parker Huggett.
Big welcome, and we're really excited to have Alfonso Balasun join our podcast today. He is a construction executive based out of London, Ontario, with 30 years of industry experience, had a successful tour of duty, championing such roles as construction manager, ops manager, senior vice president. He's an engineer by training. He's now an entrepreneur. And welcome, Alfonso.
Good morning, Matt. Thank you. I'm very excited to, you know, join this podcast and talk about my experiences. And, you know, hopefully it'll help the younger generations and others that are in the industry, and they can draw something from my experiences. I'm really excited.
We're pumped to have you. Thanks so much for being a part of our industry podcast. You know, shout out to Thomas Strong for introducing us. And, you know, now we have another great relationship. And after all, this industry is built on relationships. So above and beyond my high level introduction, if you wouldn't mind, please share some of your experience and how your career has transitioned to date, and, you know, where you've been, how you've gotten there, and ultimately where you're going now.
Yeah, no, for sure, Matt. So maybe I'll just start, you know, about who I am, where I'm from. You know, I'm the oldest son of four boys from a first generation Italian immigrant family. I grew up in the Hamilton, Stony Creek area. You know, the neighborhood I was in was very ethnic, so I had to really learn my street smarts very early in life, or, you know, get beat up or get your lunch taken away every day. So you had to learn pretty quick on your feet. I was pretty athletic, played numerous sports. I worked really hard in school, and that, you know, that paid off. I was able to get accepted at the University of Waterloo Engineering School, probably one of the only few people in my whole area that was accepted. I graduated with a civil engineering degree, honors, dean's list, minor in management science. And, you know, Waterloo's a five-year program. I don't know if you know, but it has a very robust co-op program. And that's how I started at Elliston. I had two co-op work terms with them. My last two co-ops were with them. They, you know, they liked me. They wanted to hire me. So I started as a PM. And that's kind of how my career path started. And I was moved from all over, from Northern Ontario to Michigan, all over the place. So I was started as a PM, moved up to construction manager, ops manager, to an area leader, then to a senior VP for the Southwestern operations. And my team, when I was a senior leader, I had about 80 people that I managed at the time. I had built a senior leadership group to support me in running the operation from, and we were responsible for pretty much everything, estimating, bid pursuits, all operational, P&L, HR, recruiting, development, health and safety, marketing, and the marketing and social media really came into big play in the last couple of years, as we all know, right? So most of my time in my career as in Southwestern Ontario, we did a lot of P3 infrastructure work. So when I took over, a lot of that work was slowing down. So we kind of reinvented ourselves, figured out a couple of new businesses to get into, such as formwork and special projects, and, you know, more catered to special clients. And it went well, it took off very well, just leveraging the knowledge and technology we've been doing normally for ourselves. Now we're just expanding it to other third-party groups. Just a bit about my last years there. So a new CEO was appointed, and he or she, you know, they wanted to make a change. Just they decided that probably was best that we part ways. And, you know, it was a bit of a shock because I've been there 30 years. And I pretty much, if you think about my generation, I followed pretty much a typical career path of someone born in the late 60s, right? I was born in 67. Mm. You know, you worked hard. You got onto a really good company. You put all your effort in. You got rewarded financially and with advancement. And, you know, you moved up. And you, most people in my group would stick with the same company and retire there, which kind of was somewhat my plan, which it came to a pretty drastic change. I had when a decision was made that they wanted to make a leadership change. So I, you know, it really gave me time to reflect on my time at Elliston. It was great. I met so many great people. It did well for me. And, but, you know, sometimes you got to wonder, like, there was so much sacrifice, Matt, to get to that level with getting work done and just trying to advance your career. You made so many sacrifices that came at the expense of your family and friends. And, and sometimes you got to wonder, right? Like, was it worth it? Right. And I think today's kids, or I don't want to say kids, but today's young professionals, I think they're a lot smarter, Matt. I think they put in the effort they need, but they know how much when it's too far. You know what I mean? Like, they're pretty smart nowadays, I think. And then I did question a lot of things was it worth it? Because, you know, look what it got me. You know, you would think you'd be rewarded by being able to close out your career, but that's not the case anymore. A lot of corporation companies don't look at it that way anymore. Mm-hmm. But, you know, fortunately for me, because of this industry and, you know, obviously my skill set and the people that I know, I've been able to draw on a lot of my relationships and my leadership, and which are very marketable skills in the industry. And as you know, there's such a shortage of experienced people. There's a lot of work. So I quickly transitioned to a consulting role. I've been doing that for the last 2 years. And I've worked, Tom Strong from Wired and I have worked together, co-worked together on some projects with smaller GCs in terms of helping them scale. You know, a lot of them are just working with spreadsheets and project. Like, that's it. That's how they ran their projects. And as we know, technology is a huge part of the industry that in construction that is lagging far behind in other industries. And it's been very, very good working with Tom and other and these smaller GCs and smaller developers. I spent a lot of time with a local developer here who has a tremendous amount of new rental apartments on the go that he needed a lot of help in building his development team. And it's been a great relationship in helping him recruit and build people to build these projects. And I've been very fortunate to be able to know these people in the past, and they really, really respect my knowledge. And I think that's where it's at, right? It's building those relationships and getting your name recognized by people that really understand what you can do. A lot of these people, they don't have a lot of systems. You know, Elson, that's one thing it was very strong at. It had a lot of established systems, a lot of processes that smaller groups haven't even figured out yet. And it's a huge value in the industry. It's very, very well respected. And just simple things like operationally in terms of KPI metrics and how to manage, projects, to know early on, the key in lighting construction is to know early on when you're in trouble and when you need to bring in the support, when you need to draw from your bench. And a lot of times it's too late and you're firefighting. And that's kind of where senior support helps in not getting to that point. So, you know, I don't know if I went over a little too much, but hopefully we can draw on some of those things. By the way, I personally, I'm still married after 30 years. Thankfully, my wife, Lucy, still wants to be with me. I have two much older daughters. They're in their 20s. And a lot of my hobbies are sports, football being number one, and racing. I love racing and the F1 and college sports also. I love college sports because you just, especially college basketball, because these guys, they give it all on the court. Like, there's, and everybody plays defense. Mm-hmm. That's what I love about it, right? Because they play as a team and as a unit. I also am a pretty avid cyclist, and I really enjoy track days with my little 350Z that I have. So, you know, I'm pretty diverse in my hobbies, but I'll get into the track days later on in our about how you were able to meet new people and really find those skill sets in places where you would never think you'd find them.
Yeah, amazing. I'm a cyclist as well. It's an expensive hobby.
Well, at first, yes. But so I parallel cycling in management. So when you watch the Tour de France and other, you know that it's a team of 9 people. Everybody has a role and everybody has a job to do. Everybody accepts their role. Sometimes you're the grunt. You just got to pull for 100K so that the GC rider can save his energy to have his strength at the end. One guy just keeps feeding the team, goes back to the team car and feeds the team. But having everybody know their role is so, and that parallels to our business 100%. And unfortunately, leaders need to understand that when they have a team, if they don't have people that are singing this from the same page and everybody wants to be the boss and everybody thinks they know the answers, then you gotta fix things, right? Everybody needs to know their role. And there'll be a time when their time comes to maybe become the GC rider, right? So I parallel that quite a bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at any great athlete, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, he had a coach, you know, and the Lakers had a team and they had a system. And I love the parallels between, you know, business management and sports as well. You know, if you get into, not to geek out, but to EOS traction, and you get into things like the accountability and responsibility chart, and you strip away all the names and you look at all the responsibilities and you put those responsibilities in those charts, then it becomes your playbook, and then you know the team is formed versus, you know, the ego championing the vision or sovereigning the company initiative. And I think a lot of companies are missing the playbook. And you know, it's exciting to hear that after 30 years in the industry, you're leveraging the playbook of success through systems and processes and, you know, successful project ventures to the benefit of those who are trying to make that rise. And, exactly. You know, they're leveraging your organizational and professional experience to the benefit of that. And innovation too. I think, you know, that is such a pillar that is being exploited now. I think at the Canadian Construction Association a few years ago, construction was next to hunting and fishery on the innovation list with using technology. So,
yes, true.
You know, and I'm happy to see that technology is at the forefront, and it's exciting to see, you know, VDC managers, and it's really cool to see the VR experience that's out there or managing projects from a technology perspective. And, you know, the fact that you and Thomas are leveraging that experience at Wired is really cool. Just want to get into a situation where you've nailed it. So had a major success with a higher personal situation that led or bled into a positive professional outcome, or any other work-related successes that you could think of that, you know, maybe are one of top two big highlights in your career.
Absolutely. So back to my, you know, sports and hobbies subject. And it's interesting to note that, because I'm the type of person that I'm not afraid of doing anything, right? I like doing different things. So 10, 15 years ago, I wanted to become like a better, like I love racing, right? So I wanted to be able to kind of learn how to drive my car fast or go to certain schools. So I was told a lot of the F1 drivers and a lot of, they started go-karting, right? Go-karting is the basis of understanding of how a vehicle handles power when you have grip, the racing line. So I decided to take up competitive go-karting, and I met so many incredible people in that experience, right? So because I wanted to try something different, it opened up so many new things. So a great example of like nailing it with an employee or person is, so when I started, I would go to the track. I would have some support from someone who helped me get into it, who was also became a business partner and a joint venture partner was, Max DeAngelis of Fortis. And he's still a very, very good friend of mine. But anyway, so you go to the track. And if you ever been to a like competitive kind of racing situation, it's, you know, everyone's got their own tents and everyone's got their stuff and what kind of tire, what kind of gears, you know, it's kind of guarded because every day, you know, every track layout is a little different. Anyway, there was this individual that worked for one of the teams. His name was JP, and he's a very good friend of mine now. And he was a young engineer, very bright. And I would just see all the other teams going to their trailer asking about this and that. And he would be like the knowledge of what gear to use, what tire pressure. And I said to myself, wow, this kid's got it going. Well, I wasn't a kid, but whatever. Young man has it going. And I thought, this guy needs to work for us. So I offered him a job. We had a job in the Windsor area. It was a brand new, pretty complicated design build pool project. And I offered him a job, and timing was great. He graduated from Western. He needed to get his experience to get his PEng. And it was just a home run. He killed it. He was right into the details, very complicated system with how the pool system worked with dehumidification so you wouldn't build up too much moisture in the pool area. And there was a high-end competition pool area, and there was a like a water park, right? So they worked together. Sorry, I may be getting into too much of the deal, but bottom line is he killed it, and he worked with my team and advanced from like a project corner right to becoming a director, kind of a building systems. Now he's since left and gone on his own with his own business and into energy, power energy with the Kohler Group. But again, there's a great example of you never know where you're going to find talent and skills. You may not find it in your traditional areas. You always have to be open and see where talent exists for your group and where they can add value. And in that same experience, I met so many great people that are such good friends of mine today that I never would have met if I didn't have this desire to try something different, right?
Yeah, I love that. I think, you know, this is nothing. This is a conversation I know I've been having for a very long time. And, you know, when you look at getting outside of the traditional way of hiring in construction and development, it's amazing what you'd find, because if you created the traits or like the avatar of the ideal hire, and that's like the right attitude, willingness to learn, a desire to try something new, could take constructive feedback, whatever that is, that, you know, that culture piece, you won't need to convince someone to stay they will authentically stay there because they're interested in the role. And then you're getting the right mindset versus, you know, it's us versus them or it's all about me. And then you lose control of crowning the company before crowning yourself. I think that is a fundamental change when we look at the labor shortages, not just in construction, across all industries. I've even had to do it for my own business. So I love that share. And I think the industry needs to do more of that. You can train skills. You cannot train life experiences and attitude. So what challenges in your experience are, like if we were to pull from the experience bank, trying something new or, you know, getting out there to, you know, think about hiring someone with a different mindset. Was there like a, maybe a challenge or I don't want to call them a failure, but like an experience that you leveraged that bled into making that decision to hire, you know, someone outside of industry? Did anything instigate that or is that just instincts?
You know what, Matt? Again, like you said, it's a lot of it is instincts. Like I said, where, you know, I grew up in a, you know, very ethnic community and you had to have your wits about you. Always had to have your spidey senses of where your threats and challenges were. So you always, you know, so for me, a lot of it is instincts, right? And usually for me, it's first impressions. And, you know, it's a cliche, but a lot of times your first impressions are right. Like as soon as you meet someone, like the perception the first time you meet someone is usually right. Not often in cases where your first impressions are. There are very few cases where I was wrong in my first impressions with certain individuals. But in most cases, it's that first impression, that first 15 or 20 second interaction, you pretty much frame in your mind. And that, unfortunately, in today works, you know, with everything going on in diversity and culture and inclusion is a big part of changing that too, right? Because that's a huge, very important initiative right now is making our industry far more diverse with more women, more individuals of different ethnics. You know, we very much have been a very, you know, white male dominated industry and that needs to change 100%. And I think for me, like you said, that going out of my comfort zone, I've not had too many issues where I brought someone in from outside the normal tradition where it's not worked out. So I've been fortunate that way.
That's amazing. It's good to hear that the success rate has been high in that regard because yeah, you could put a lot more faith than fear into that method going forward, right? And creating a bigger industry and adding, you know, that diverse hire and adding that, you know, maybe that's someone who hasn't had the best of luck in being able to get education, but they're super smart and get into the trades and then they grow their career. Like how many of those stories have we heard? I think that's a great direction the industry needs to go in.
No, 100%. And I think a lot of leaders should not be afraid because a lot of times when you have an idea about a hire or where you've seen some or met someone and you think, you know what, this person is, I think they'd be a good fit. And then, you know, you go back to your senior team or your HR or people in culture and you tell them you want to speak further with them. And they kind of say, well, are you sure? They, you know, they don't really fit these. They don't mark these checks in the checkbox. And a lot of times, a lot of leaders will say, yeah, you know, maybe, you know what? Just go with your instincts, man. Like you are the boss. You have the control of your group and you should follow that instinct. And remember, to be great or to be so successful, you have to have some failures, right? You have to have some struggles. You can't go through life hitting home runs all the time because you never learn anything, right? The only way you learn is by having a few of those failures and learning from it and drawing from it and what you could do better.
Yeah, that's definitely a core part of the process to develop instincts is like whether you're conscious of it or not, you've been able to pick up on that situation so you can have that visceral response when you're making a decision. And the business is all about making decisions, you know, and they could be good ones or bad ones, but the ability to make the decision is really key. And hiring an individual who has, you know, the mindsets, the street smarts, whatever that is you're looking for is going to be, you know, the difference between having a leader and not having one.
Well, Matt, I think that's a lot of your challenges, right? Because that's your role in terms of bringing candidates to prospective candidates to owners. You probably see something that they don't see. And I'm assuming you've run into that numerous times yourself.
Oh, 100%. There's been situations outside looking in, and I talk about this with my team all the time. I say, there are going to be candidates that we turn down that are going to get hired by our clients.
Yeah.
And there are going to be candidates or clients that look at this resume, which is the most archaic form of candidacy.
Yes.
You know, as a barrier to entry to have a conversation, right? to get to know the individual, to channel those instincts. And a lot of times we need to remove the blinders from our clients and just say, look, it's a conversation. Just speak to this person for these X, Y, Z reasons. I think there's alignment here, but you know, this is where they may fall short, but this is what would tip the scales to be a potential good fit. So yeah, there's, you know, as the middle person in the process, it's definitely something we talk about behind the scenes for sure. So in your opinion, Alfonso, what does the general contracting and development industry in Canada do really well?
What we do well here is, and again, this is over my many years, is building strong relationships with key trades. Because at the end of the day, especially in the building industry, you know, there's three or four key trades that carry the weight, right? Like, and if you're going to get something done, like your mechanical, electrical, your structure, your now your networker, network people, you ain't going to get to the finish line unless you have the right people with the right financial backing and the resources to get done. It's not about low price all the time. It's about getting the right price with the right skill set. So I think this industry understands, in Canada especially, US is also very good for that. Europeans, I don't know about so much because they're a lot more about price. But here in North America, we put a lot of value in our key trade relationships and getting the work done. I think that's what we do really well in Canada for sure.
What do you feel the industry's biggest challenge ahead is?
Well, I'm sure you've heard this thousands of times. Obviously, lack of people, especially at the field level, right? Trade level. It's, you know, people are, our generation's getting older. A lot of the, you know, the mid 50s or so trades people are retiring, and there isn't, they haven't done a really good job at, you know, promoting it through schools. And immigration's been a problem, right? Immigration, we need to fix it. We need to bring in so many qualified people from, you know, Eastern Europe or wherever in the world that would love to come to Canada, have a great life and make a very good living. And that's for sure the number one issue is the lack of qualified people or trades, because we have so much to do still, right? We've major infrastructure projects still to come, and similar with infrastructure facilities and housing, as you know, significant issue with housing. So that'd be the first step for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, the second challenge, you hit it on the head, is technology, is the slow adoption of technology in this industry is the second biggest challenge. And I'm not sure. I think it's getting a lot better. I think a lot of the new leaders get it and they're willing to spend the money and the effort to do that. But when you go to certain manufacturing facilities where you push a button and there's like three people working and they're doing, and all these machines doing all this work, you figure how and how is that ever going to be related to the thing? Like I've done a lot of projects for like automotive people such as Toyota and GM, and they always try to boil construction down to manufacturing somehow, some process. They give us all their sheets they want us to fill out in their product, but they fail to realize that construction can be like manufacturing, but it's not manufacturing. It's more like organized chaos, right? Where there's so many variables, especially because we're not using the same sub-trade 1,000 times doing the same thing over and over, where they use the same part supplier for a 5-year contract. And they know exactly, it's all predicted, right? Our business is engineered, but it's engineered with experience because every job is different, right? So definitely technology and the adoption of technology from, and it's getting better with virtual design being a huge part of pre-construction modeling and a lot of the logistics pre-planning, but also the monitoring, right? The project management tools that we have to obtain real live data in terms of what was done today, how much production, did we meet our targets? There's some great tools Tom and I looked at with, especially with the use of 3D cameras, right? You can put this 3D camera on your helmet, have the super walk around, and based on how everything's mapped, digitally map everything into a format, the super has the same pattern that he walks around the job. By just visually taking pictures of the status of the drywall or studs or ductwork, it automatically can calculate the percentage complete of the various trades just by walking around and taking a visual picture. Like, that's incredible.
Wow. That's amazing. In your opinion, why should youth strongly consider a career in construction and development?
Well, I mean, when I talk to young people about, you know, careers, and because they're really mixed up, right, Matt? A lot of young people really just don't know, right? They don't know what they like, you know. So if you like being around people, if you like technology, to some extent in terms of different programs and applications. If you like learning about different industries, if you like the project management of planning and logistics and always, you know, being extremely busy with your job. And most importantly, if you like meeting new people and creating new relationships, you're not going to find a better industry than our in the construction industry. I've met so many incredible people over my 30 plus years that are still good friends, and that I've been so lucky that I've drawn on so many incredible experience and knowledge and advice, because you're at one stage of your career, they're either much further in their career and they have so much more that they've learned that you can learn from, right? And if you want to find an industry where there's people are so open to, you know, sharing information like that, I don't think you're going to find a better industry.
Agreed. That's what keeps me coming back is the personalities, the wide variety of different personalities and characters. And I love that about the industry. You know, I kind of growing up, I wish someone in my high school would have told me how much trades make. You know, shouldn't be a fallback conversation. It should be this is very much a great career. Sets of craft and, you know, and ultimately the income you could make to provide for your family, and it's not going away. Awesome. Well, Alfonso, I appreciate you taking the time. This has been great. What a way to end the year for Parker Huggett's Nailed It podcast. And it's an absolute honor and privilege to have you on the show and have you share some of your experience.
No, thank you so much, Matt. I love what I do. I still have a lot to learn, obviously, but I love the industry. I love the people. And it's a business that I don't think you ever retire from. You always will be doing something in this field. It's not something that you can just shut off. So, I mean, I really appreciate having me on the show and talking about my experiences.
Oh, our pleasure. And we will definitely be in touch soon. I hope you have a great day.
Yes. Thank you, Matt.